In Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer's new book, he passionately argues that when issuing rulings these days, the court must consider the world beyond U.S. borders. That, however, sets up an obvious and immediate tension because the court's duty is to interpret the constitutionality of American law. Therefore, Breyer's critics would say any consideration of international issues, politics, or law subverts the primacy of the U.S. Constitution. But in The Court and the World, American Law and the New Global Realities, Breyer's right that justices often have no choice in the matter. Some 20% of the cases they hear today have an international component. And when he spoke with us, Justice Breyer gave us an example, seemingly mundane, but in his view, emblematic. It's Kurtzang versus Wiley, a 2013 case that challenged U.S. copyright law.
A student who goes to Cornell, he's from Thailand, and he noticed that the books in Thailand, the very books he was using, were sold in Thailand a lot cheaper. So he wrote to his parents and said, please send me copies. And they sent copies. In fact, they sent a lot of copies, and he sold them.
All right. This is the case about banning the importation of textbooks. That's right.
Yes. And after a while, the publisher came to get a little annoyed and sued him. And the question before us in that case was whether six words in the Copyright Act applied and allowed him to do it or didn't allow him to do it. Now, I noticed a pile of briefs probably a foot and a half thick on that question from lawyers all over the world. I wondered why on this technical matter. And we were told, well, copyright today is a question not just of books or even films or music. It's in automobiles. After all, automobiles have software, which is copyrighted. You go into a store and you will see labels. They're all, not all, but many are copyrighted on every product you can think of. And the bottom line was, we think, said one of the briefs, that your answer in this case will affect $3.6 trillion worth of commerce. Now, that's a lot of money even today. And we couldn't answer the question in that case, a matter of American law, without knowing quite a lot about what happened abroad in terms of copyright, publishers, practices, all sorts of things.
Can you remind us how the court ended up deciding on the textbook case?
We decided in favor of the student.
Much to the relief of tens of thousands of students in the United States.
That's correct. That's correct.
Well, there's a section where you write that by virtue of even saying that judges should take into consideration what's happening globally, that, quote, you know, some foreign governments fear that, quote, American judges will apply an Americanized version of the law, and some Americans worry about their law becoming more internationalized. I mean, are those valid concerns?
They're valid concerns, but I think you have to look at the examples, and that's why the book is chock full of examples. The one I like is, I think it absolutely illustrates the point, is Dolly Phil Ortega. Is it all right if I tell you that for a minute?
Yes, absolutely, please.
All right. Dolly Phil Ortega comes to New York from Paraguay. She's a citizen of Paraguay in the 70s. She finds in New York another man from Paraguay, the man who had tortured her brother to death. And she also finds an old law of America, passed in the 1790s, probably to help the victims of pirates. And that law says that she can get damages as a result of an injury caused in violation of the law of nations. Now, that's an American statute. She won. She went back to Paraguay. Well, naturally, her winning led to a lot of other lawsuits by other people who were victims of other things. And now we have to begin the job of interpretation. Who are today's pirates? And more than that, suppose you have to have an interpretation of this statute, so were it to apply in other countries, and were other countries to apply their law, well, you can imagine the chaos. Mm-hmm. It's got to be roughly uniform, and there's no way to work this statute unless you figure out what's going on abroad.
There are many people out there, some of them are your fellow justices, who still return to the basic notion of the sanctity and supremacy of the United States Constitution, that all the tools that the justices need lie there within.
Well, you see, that's rather hard to say exactly what it is that they're saying. If, for example, we are supposed to decide whether or not in a time of terrorism the president has the power to put people, let's say, into confinement Can the president deprive such a person of access to our federal courts? The Guantanamo detainees? Can Congress do that? We said no, but if we're going to continue to decide those cases, we have to know something about the problem. The problem is international. And it is very helpful to know what other countries, also democracies, are doing in respect to the same kind of problem. That's not denying our Constitution. That's enforcing our Constitution.
So this is very, very fascinating, because we can talk a lot about cases that you and your fellow justices have heard, but there's also sort of the mirror image of that. You know, for example, I was thinking Google and Microsoft, they have both been taken to court in Europe for various reasons, antitrust, privacy issues. So here we have two major U.S. companies whose activities were ostensibly legal in the United States, but were dragged into court in Europe. Do you and your fellow justices look at cases like that and how they play out abroad to, you know, deepen and further inform your understanding, as you were saying, about America and American jurisprudence?
Yes. For example, you mentioned antitrust. We have a case where a plaintiff from Ecuador, for example, a vitamin distributor, sues a company in Holland, a manufacturer who he says fixed prices with other manufacturers. And where does he bring the lawsuit? New York. But can he bring this lawsuit in New York? And that's a question of looking at the statute and how far our statutes extend and who they extend to. And you can't answer that question without understanding something about European antitrust law and how it's enforced. Indeed, outside our judicial world of the courts, the antitrust authorities in the United States and Washington and those in the European Union meet regularly in order to have a coordinated approach, and they both filed briefs in our cases in order to make certain that our answer to a legal question reflects their need for cooperation at the administrative level. That's a very common kind of thing. We have the Bluefin Whale Commission, the International Olive Oil Council, if I've got it right, and hundreds of such organizations are in fact area by area making rules that do affect us.
Well, we began this conversation by you telling us that the need to consider global realities is a major change that you've seen in your 21 years on the court. Can you tell us what you think some of the other biggest changes are that the Supreme Court has undergone since you became a justice?
It's a change in personnel. And Justice White said, with every new appointment, it's a new court. And there is some truth to that. The dynamic is different. The people are different. Now, how that leads to differences in terms of results, no one can really predict.
I was just asking because it seems to me that regardless of how the court decides on the high-profile cases, that someone out there accuses the court of being an activist one. I mean, is that just the reality of the role that the Supreme Court plays in American life today?
Well, activist is usually meant in a pejorative way.
Indeed.
First, we're unanimous 50% of the time about. The 5-4s that you read about are probably 20% of the cases, not always the same 5, same 4 by any means. But questions where, for example, that word liberty in the 14th Amendment or the word the freedom of speech in the First Amendment. Not only do those words not explain themselves, but cases arise where the precedent and language of the text and the language of that Constitution doesn't answer the question, and they affect a lot of people. We're the Boundary Patrol. That boundary is defined by a Constitution with very open language. So no wonder the questions are difficult. I mean, is abortion inside or outside? And what about the death penalty? What about campaign finance? When those questions come before us with the openness of the language and with the difficulty of deciding the case, it's not surprising that they are on page 1 of the Constitution because they affect a lot of people. But it's important to remember that we are just interpreting what's in that Constitution that sets boundaries. And within those boundaries, there is a vast, vast area for the people, through the democratic process, to decide what kinds of towns, cities, states, and nations they want. That's why we have elections. But I can tell you, if you refuse to participate in your community's affairs, this document that I and others have a job of interpreting won't work. That's what Adams thought. That's what Jefferson and Madison and the others thought. They saw communities where people would participate. The Supreme Court's job is to patrol the boundary. That's not to say what this country will be like.
Well, Stephen Breyer is an associate justice on the United States Supreme Court. His new book is The Court and the World, American Law and the New Global Realities. Justice Breyer, it's been an honor and a pleasure. Thank you so very much.
Well, thank you.